left off last class showing how you get the masses for the W and the Z through the covariant term of the Higgs once the Higgs gets a VeV. Now we're going to consider the fermion terms, specifically just the gauge kinetic terms for the fermion interactions. So here's one part of the standard model Lagrangian, which includes all of the fermions that we wrote down. So it's a sum over all types of fermions psi, I, d slash, psi. And again, I can't write down any mass terms because they violate the gauge symmetry. And we'll see how they come from Yukawa interactions later. But now let me just expand the covariant derivative term for all of the different flavors of fermions. So there's a lot of terms. So it's a little bit complicated. So first, let me write it down for the left-handed quark field. It has a generation index I, and then I have I, and then I'll just expand the covariant derivative. So I have d slash, and then I need to include all the gauge interactions. So I have SU2 left. I have U1 hypercharge. And then I have color. And then I have Q left I. So I just want to go over where all of these terms come from. Just to remember, G was the gauge coupling for SE2 left. The generator for SE2 left was Pauli matrix divided by 2. The hypercharge of Q left was 1/6, so that's why I have to divide by 6 here. The gauge coupling is G prime. Then for color, here's the gauge field for the gluon. The generator is the Gell-Mann matrix lambda A divided by 2. And then the gauge coupling is this GS. So those are all of the terms. This little a goes over from 1 to 3. The big A goes from 1 to 8, summing over all of the generators of the respective groups. OK, so that was just one field. Now I need to write down all of the other fields as well. So there's the right-handed quark fields. So it looks very similar, except there's no SE2 color. And the hypercharge is 2/3 instead of 1/6. And it has a similar interaction for color. Then we have the down-type quark fields. Okay, then I have the leptons. So I start with the left-handed lepton doublet. So I have SE2 left. Minus. And then I have the right-handed electron fields. Okay, so it's a little bit repetitive to write all this out, but it's good to just see it for once. So here are all the gauge interactions. And so I want to go through them all, the different types, one at a time. Let's just start with the kinetic terms. So the d slash terms. the d slash terms are just the usual kinetic terms for fermions. And although I've written it down in this chiral way, hopefully it's obvious that the different chiral components just pair up to give you just the standard kinetic term. So I can just write it down for quarks, let's say. So if I include all of the quark terms, I'll have q left I d slash q left I bar here. U right bar I d slash u right I plus d bar right I d slash d right I. And now if I just expand the left-handed doublet, I get u bar left d slash u left plus d left d slash d left. And then the right-handed ones, which I just wrote down previously. So, I think this was kind of obvious, but the left-handed and the right-handed components just sort of pair up, and I could just write it down as the full four-component spinner. So I'll have u bar I d slash u plus d bar I d slash d. Okay, so we just get the usual kinetic terms for the fermions. Then the gluon terms, they also pair up in a similar way. So the left-handed and right-handed components can be combined, and I'll just get so I've got I squared minus sign GS gluon field strength, or the gluon field, I should say, and then U bar I gamma mu lambda A over 2 UI plus D bar I gamma mu lambda A over 2 DI, like so. So the argument is exactly the same. The left-handed and right-handed components, when I expand them out, you can just pair them up to form the four-component spinners. Okay, so far so good. So now let's consider the electroweak interactions, which are more complicated and more interesting. So these will include the W, the Z, and the photon. So first, let's consider just what are called charge-current interactions. So those will only be the interactions of the W. The interactions of the Z and the photon are called neutral current interactions. We'll come to those in a second. So let me write down the gauge interaction terms, which only concern the W boson. So those will only arise from the left-handed fields, of course, since the right-handed fields don't carry SU2 left. So I have one term for quarks, which will look like this. And the W and plus and minus, just to recall, come from W1 and W2 components of the weak field. And so those only live along the 1 and 2 components of the Pauli matrix, which will live in the off diagonals here. So in the upper component, I get W1 minus I W2 slash, and then I'll get W1 slash plus I W2 slash, like this. And then I have Q left I. And then I have a similar form for the leptons. It's actually just the same. I have I L bar times I G over 2. And then I have 0 W1 slash minus I W2 slash W1 slash plus I W2 slash 0. And then the left-handed lepton doublet I. OK, so I think that's it. And then, as we mentioned last time, and as I think you're aware, This is W plus, and this is W minus. If I just do a field redefinition, you can treat them as a complex field. And so let me expand that out. All right, so using the fact that W plus minus is equal to 1 over the square root of 2, W1 minus plus I, W2. All right, so then the charge current interaction takes the following form. I have minus G over the square root of 2. I am going to expand the left-handed quark doublet. So I have U left I, D left I bar. I have 0, W plus slash, W minus slash 0. And then I have U left I, D left I. And I have exactly the same thing for the leptons. I just have to expand the lepton doublet as the neutrino. How do I want to write that? And then E left I bar 0, W plus slash, W minus slash 0, and then neutrino lepton, charge lepton, like this. Okay, so now it's straightforward. I can multiply everything out. Here's what I get. The W plus terms will be G over square root of 2. U bar left I, W plus slash, D left I, minus G over the square root of 2, new left I bar, W plus slash, E left I. And then the W minus terms, I can just treat as plus emission conjugate. Okay, so those are the charge current interactions. Yeah.
It's a factor, right? So how many components does it have?
It has many components. So I'm hiding many indices. It has 4 components because it has 3 indices for color. It has 2 indices for SU2. And then the Dirac indices, it depends a little bit about how you count. I'm really just defining Q left, or let's say U left, to be P left acting on U. And so that object will have 4 components. But only 2 of the components are, it effectively has only 2 dynamical components because it's only the left-handed component. So,
okay. The fact that you're multiplying by a 2 times 2 matrix, that is the SU2, that's the SU2 part. And then each component is like a Dirac matrix.
Exactly. I'm hiding all of the Dirac indices, the color indices. I'm really just expanding out the SU2 part. Because that's the only part that's affected by spontaneous symmetry breaking.
And W is invariant under SU2.
No.
It's not a matrix anymore.
No, so it's the gauge field, so it transforms as a gauge field under SU2.
So it's a matrix?
No. It's what you would write out as the matrix would be like W A mu times the generator, sigma A over 2. And so this would be the matrix, W3 mu, W1 mu minus I, W2 mu, and then W1 mu plus I, W2 mu minus W3 mu, and then divide all that by 2. So this would be the matrix. But the individual fields appearing in the matrix, they just get mixed up amongst themselves under the gauge transformation. All right, so So that's the charge current interaction. Let's come to the neutral current interaction. Maybe it's clear, but the reason for calling it charge-current interaction is because you're changing the charge. Ultimately, what we'll see is the electric charge of the fermion through the interaction of the W. So that's why it's called the charge-current interaction. Here you're not. So these are the interactions of the photon and the Z. So let's start out by just writing out the neutral current interaction and expanding it. And we'll see what the interactions are. So I have Q left I, and then I have G over 2, then I have W3 slash 0, 0, W3, minus W3 slash, and then I have G prime over 6. 6 was the hypercharge of the Q left field. And now I have the B mu component, which is just proportional to the identity in SE2 space. So I can just write down B slash, B slash. Okay? And then I have Q left I. All right, so I'll just write down the same things for the other fields as well. So I have U right I. Then I have 2/3 G prime B slash. U right I minus D right I, and then minus 1/3 G prime B slash D right I. So those are all of the neutral current interactions for the quarks. And for the leptons, it looks very similar. G over 2, W3 slash minus W3 slash 0, 0. The only difference is the hypercharge is minus a half now. So I have G prime over 2, B slash, and then I have the right-handed electron, or lepton, charge lepton doublet, minus G prime, B slash, E right. Okay. So again, I want to expand all of this out. And there's the additional complication, which is that the W3 and B, the hypercharge gauge field, are not the eigenstates. But I need to transform into the eigenstate basis, which is the Z and the photon. So here's what you do. You would want to write W3 mu is equal to cosine theta W Z mu plus sine theta W A mu, and B mu is the orthogonal combination minus sine theta W Z mu plus cosine theta W A mu. All right. So you can imagine when you plug this into here and expand it out, you get lots of terms. So we're going to simplify it a little bit and just consider one fermion. So we're just going to consider a generic fermion, which will have components, chiral components, psi left and psi right. So in this case, the neutral current interaction can be written as the following way. So I've got minus psi left. So now I need to write down the W3 part. And you can see that it's always proportional to G over 2. Then times either plus 1 or minus 1, depending on whether it's the upper component or the lower component of the SE2 doublet. So I'm going to write that plus or minus 1 half as T3 left. So it's the eigenvalue of the T3 generator for SE2 left, which is just plus a half or minus a half, depending on whether this is the upper component or the lower component. All right, and so that is multiplying W3 slash. And so I'm going to plug in the formula for W3 slash. Cosine theta W z mu slash, or z slash, plus sine theta W a slash. Now I have the hypercharge. So I have g prime times whatever the hypercharge is. I'll just call it y left. And then it's times b slash. So I should write minus sine theta W z slash plus cosine theta W a slash. And then I have psi left. And then I guess I need another parenthesis. So that's just a generic form of what I wrote down above for an arbitrary left-handed component. Then I have the right-handed components, which only has hypercharge. So I can write it as g prime times whatever the hypercharge is times b slash. And so I just plug in for this. I have minus sine squared sine theta w z slash plus cosine theta w a slash. And then I have psi right. OK, so again, this is just a generic form of what I wrote down above. So y left and right are the hypercharges for psi left and psi right. And T3 left is equal to plus or minus 1 half, depending on whether psi left is an upper or lower component. Of an SE2 vector. OK, so hopefully the notation is clear. The last thing I just want to remind you is that I want to expand g prime instead of in terms of g. And so I need to remember the formula that g prime is equal to g times tangent theta w. All right, so now I'm just going to expand this all out. OK, so I'm going to group the terms together and expand them out a little bit. So the neutral current interaction. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, instead of writing down psi left and psi right, I'm going to write psi left as p left acting on psi. And I'll write psi right as p right acting on psi. So I'll have psi bar, and then I'll have the following. So now I'll do the left-handed part that's proportional to the photon field A slash. So I'll have G T3 left sine theta W plus G prime hypercharge left cosine theta W A slash P left. So that was this term here, and then this term here. And then similarly for the right-handed component, I have g prime y right cosine theta w a slash p right. So those are the photon interactions. And then I have the z interactions. So I'll have a g T3 left, cosine theta W minus G prime, Y left, sine theta W, Z slash, P left, minus G prime, Y right, sine theta W, Z slash, P right. And all that is multiplying psi. OK. So then lastly, I'm going to substitute in for g prime in terms of g. And I'm going to use tangent theta w to kind of simplify things a little bit. So here's what we get. Minus psi bar LFG sine squared sine theta w a slash. And then I'll have the following combination of couplings. I'll have T3 left plus Y left, P left. And then I'll have Y right times P right. So that's the terms involving the photon field. And then for the terms involving the Z fields, I'll have G over cosine theta. Z slash, and I'll have T3 left, 1 minus sine squared theta w, minus y left, sine squared theta w, p left, and then I have a plus minus y r, p right. Sine squared theta w, p right. Okay, and all of that is acting on psi. Okay, so there's a bunch of terms. All right, so this last little term in parentheses, let me just expand that out. That is T3 left minus T3 left plus Y left sine squared theta W. Like that. Okay. So now I have these particular combinations appearing in the interaction. And so let's plug in for specific fermion fields what they are. So for the U right field, I'll have this combination T3 left plus Y left. This is equal to 1/2. Plus a sixth, which is 2/3. So that's proportional to that coupling of the photon to the left-handed component of the fermion. For U right, the photon coupling is proportional to Y right, and Y right for the up-handed quark, right-handed quark, is also 2/3. So the 2/3 means, having 2/3 for both of these two things, means that the photon doesn't have a chiral interaction to the up quark. It has the same coupling to both left and right-handed quarks. And that coupling is just proportional to what we would think of as the electric charge. So this we would define as the electric charge of the up quark. Now, for the down quark fields, we have T3 left plus Y left is minus 1/2 plus a sixth, and that's equal to minus 1/3. And then for D right, we have Y right is equal to minus 1/3. So again, we get the same value. This is equal to the electric charge of the down quark. And then lastly, E left as T3 left plus Y left is minus 1/2. Minus 1/2 is minus 1. And E right is Y right. And that was equal to minus 1. So both of the left and right-hand components of the electron field also have the same coupling to the photon. Yeah?
You're using like a bunch of numbers here everywhere. Is that all experimental data?
No, so I'm only plugging in the quantum numbers that we assigned at the when we defined all of the fields in the standard model, we identified what all of the quantum numbers are, and so I'm only using what the quantum numbers are.
So like the table you drew last time.
Yeah,
where you said the interaction between that field and that gauge field is like this, has this quantum number. That's all predicted by the standard model.
Yeah, so let me just write down the table again. So the fields are, you have Q left, or maybe I should do it on a different board. So we wrote down the fields and the quantum numbers. And so we had Q left, which was U left, D left. And this was a triplet, a doublet, and then it had hypercharge 1/6. D right. Where does it come from? So it doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't come from anywhere. So the whole motivation is to write down a phenomenologically consistent model.
Yeah, so those numbers, the 3, 2, and 1, 6, those are experimental.
No, they're not experimental.
So they come from somewhere.
So it's not, it's a...
Like everything is either theoretical.
I mean, I guess, yeah. So everything is experimental in the sense that... we observe certain fields appearing in nature, and we want to write down a Lagrangian for those fields, and so we need to specify what quantum numbers they have under the interactions of the theory.
Yes.
And so that's the experimental question. But it's not that these numbers need to be measured, perhaps, because once you fix what the quantum numbers are, they just are what they are.
Yeah, so how do you fix them? By looking at data. Your theory doesn't predict that it's 1/6.
Yeah, it doesn't predict that it's 1/6.
Either the theory predicts it or data predicts it. It comes from somewhere.
No, I mean, you're right. So the whole motivation of setting up the standard model is phenomenological. So we want to choose the quantum numbers just by hand so that we end up having a phenomenologically viable setup. Okay? But there's no higher motivation for picking these numbers. From the point of view of the standard model. If you want to go beyond the standard model, you can think about that. Right, let me just write down what it is for quarks. So this was 3, and it was a singlet, and I forgot about U. This is 2/3. And D right is 3, 1, minus 1/3. So the numbers that I'm plugging in here for T left are either just plus 1/2 or minus 1/2, depending on which component you're talking about. And then I'm just plugging in the hypercharges for each of these fields. So that's where these numbers are coming from. So I had 1/6, 2/3, and then minus 1/3. Okay. I forgot the neutrinos. So left at T3 left plus Y left. So this was the upper component. So it's 1/2 minus 1/2 is equal to 0. And so again, the electric charge of the neutrino will be 0 appearing in here. Okay, so the electric charge Q it always couples, or I should say the photon field always couples to this particular combination of T3 left plus the hypercharge. For the right-handed fields, you have no T3 left, and so it only couples proportional to the hypercharge. So the fact that we always took for the right-handed and left-handed components hypercharges such that T3 left plus Y left was equal to Y right, this tells us that the photon will always couple the same to both the left-handed and the right-handed fields. Okay? So now I can write down in a simpler form what the neutral current interactions are. I have the photon coupling is just minus E times the electric charge, psi bar A slash psi. And then for the Z, it's still a little bit more complicated. So it's actually at the top of that board up there. So I still have this combination appearing of T3 left plus Y left, and I also have Y right appearing in the right-handed coupling. And so those can be paired up and expressed in terms of the electric charge. Write down what I want to say. And so the coupling to the Z ends up being G over cosine theta W, psi bar, Z slash. And then I still have this chiral coupling of T3 left, P left, minus the electric charge times sine squared theta W, psi. So this ends up being the coupling of the photon. This is just the normal thing from QED. But now we have the coupling of the Z as well. And it's not a vector-like coupling. It couples different to left-handed and right-handed fermions. Right. So what is the electric charge? So the electric charge is now just this combination, G times sine theta W. Okay, so even though we started with the chiral theory, provided we pick the right quantum numbers for our fields initially, we're able to arrive at a theory in which the photon is not only massless, but it couples non-chirally, couples in a vector-like way to both left-handed and right-handed fermions. Let me just write down, for example, just to be very clear, for one species, for quarks, let's say, what the neutral current interaction is. So for up-type quarks, I'll just have the usual coupling of the photon to electric charge. And then for the Z, it's a little more complicated. I have G over cosine theta W, U bar I, Z mu. And then I have 1 half p left. The 1 half comes from the t3 left, which was plus or minus 1 half. For up quarks, it's 1 half. Minus the charge of the up quark, sine squared theta w, and then u I. And then for the down type quarks, I have d bar I z slash. Then I just have minus 1 half. Since it's the lower component, p left minus q d sine squared theta w d I. OK, so there, just to be concrete, this is the neutral current interaction for quarks. So those are the charge current and neutral current interactions. All right, so we still have some time left, so let's move on and talk about fermion masses. So as you know, if you want to write down psi bar psi, it's forbidden by the gauge symmetry. Because SU2 left cross U1 is chiral, we can't write it down. But we want to try to play the same trick as we did with the abelian Higgs model, where we generate fermion masses by introducing a Yukawa coupling involving the Higgs field. And then when the Higgs field gets a VeV, it will generate the masses through spontaneous symmetry breaking. OK, so before we get there, we need to recall a little bit about SU2 group theory. Because we want to write down terms in the Lagrangian that are invariant under SU2, we need to think about how we write down SU2 invariants in terms of vectors under SU2. So let's say we have two component vectors. Which transform under SU2. And I'll call them eta and xc. So these are just like fundamentals under SU2. I just want to ask, how many ways are there to contract them in an SU2 invariant way? And it turns out that there's two. There's two ways to contract them. So the obvious way is if you just have, for example, eta dagger times xc. And of course, this is an invariant for all SUn. But for SU2, it's a little bit special because there's another combination of two vectors you can write down that is invariant. And you can write down eta transpose times contracted with xc. And then in the middle, you need to introduce the antisymmetric matrix. So this is just 0, 1, minus 1, 0, which would be the antisymmetric tensor. So it's an antisymmetric matrix. And the matrix is acting on indices in SU2 space. So I just want to comment in general, SUN. This is just a reflection of the fact that there's two invariant tensors in SUN. The first one is just the identity. So if I write down delta ij, this is invariant. It's just a statement that if I have U, the identity matrix transforming to U, the identity U, this is just equal to the identity again. Lastly, I have epsilon ijk dot dot dot, which is the antisymmetric tensor. Where I have n indices, n is the same as SUN appearing here. This is also invariant. So if I have epsilon ijk dot dot dot, it will transform as ui I prime, uj j prime, etc. Epsilon I prime j prime dot dot dot. And so this combination here, due to the antisymmetry of all of the indices here, ends up just being the determinant of U, which for SUN is equal to 1. And so this whole thing is just epsilon ijk, etc. I should say 1 times the Kronecker delta for all of these different indices. OK, so for SU2, it's a little bit special because both of these are 2x2 matrices under SU2. And so you can use both to write down an invariant bilinear. And for the standard model, you do have to use both. And so there's different interactions you can write down that use either one or the other. So I can write down some Yukawa interactions. That are allowed. For example, I could have H dagger, D right bar, Q left. So just to be clear, H and Q are both doublets in SU2. And the H dagger, Q left are contracted using the identity matrix. And then the color indices are contracted between the quark fields. Spinner indices are also contracted between the quark fields. OK, so this is one example of Yukawa interaction. But I can write down others that involve using epsilon. So I can write down u bar right, q left transpose, epsilon h. This is another one that's valid. And then I have h dagger, e right, left-handed lepton doublet. So these are examples of Yukawa interactions which are valid. But I could have written down other types of Yukawa interactions which end up not being valid. So I could have also have written down D right bar, Q left transpose, epsilon H. I could have written down H dagger, U right bar, Q left, or E right bar, left-handed lepton doublet, epsilon H. So instead of not having an epsilon, I could have also contracted these fields using an epsilon. Or instead of using an epsilon, I could have contracted them without an epsilon, and vice versa. So maybe it's a question, right? Why should I write down the ones on the left but not the ones on the right? Anyone have an idea? All right, well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. Think about it. So we're just going to consider the ones on the left. No idea? All right. I asked the same question last year. People knew the answer right away, for what it's worth. Everyone loves a puzzle, right? All right, so we're just going to consider the ones on the left. Give us some thought. We'll figure it out next, talk about it on Monday. So let's do write down the Yukawa interactions. So I've omitted some indices over here, because as you know, the fermions have flavor indices or generational indices, and so I should have attached little I's and J's to these different fields. So the Yukawa interactions are a little bit complicated, because in general, any flavor can be contracted or coupled with any other flavor in generation space. That also works. So what I should write down are the following Lagrangian. So I should write down U right I, Q left J, transpose, epsilon H. Right, that was the second interaction. But now, in principle, any two combinations can have its own coupling. And so I need to think of this as a matrix. So I'll call this YU with indices I and J. So any two flavors that you pick out will have its own coupling, and so I could think of this Y as a matrix. Now I can write down the same things for the other Yukawa interactions. So D right, I forgot, H dagger, D right I, Q left J. And then I have minus y, e, I, j, h dagger, e, right, I, l, l, j. OK, so those are exactly the same ones that I wrote on the left over there. I've just added i's and j's to all of the fields. And each combination of I and j has its own coupling. And then I just have to add a plus Hermitian conjugate, because what I wrote down so far is not Hermitian. OK. So now I want to expand this out. Again, I'm just going to let the Higgs acquire VEV and work with it under the assumption of unitary gauge. So in unitary gauge, I can expand this out, where h is 1 over square root of 2, v plus h. Oops, forgot something. Should be 0. V plus H, like so, the doublet. All right, so let's plug in. So I have YU, IJ, U bar right I. OK, so now I need to figure this out a little bit. So let me try to write this down. So I want to write down Q transpose, which is U left So Q is U, D, and then transpose is just U left J, comma D left J. And then I contract it to the epsilon tensor, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And then I have 0 V plus H. And it's 1 over square root 2. So now I just need to multiply all this out. So I get this times that is minus D left for the first component. And then for this times that, I've got U left for the second component. But it's only the second component that's going to matter when I multiply it by the last vector on the right. So this whole thing will just be U left J times V plus H divided by square root of 2. OK? So I'm just expanding it out so you can just be clear on how the SU2 indices work. So this one is a little bit simpler, because I'm just contracting H dagger, which is just this dagger, times D right. Contracted with Q left. And so I'm only going to pick out the bottom component of Q left, because I only have something that's non-zero in the bottom component of H. So this is minus YD IJ over square root of 2. And then I get D right bar I D left J times V plus H. And then lastly, I have Y E I J over square root of 2, E right I, E left J, B plus H, plus emission conjugate. OK, so I think it's clear that we did successfully generate some sort of mass term here. When the Higgs acquires its VEV, V, we're generating something that looks like psi by psi. The only problem is that it's not diagonal, because in general, this matrix is not a diagonal matrix. There's no reason for it to be. So we just need to diagonalize the mass matrix. In other words, the fields that we wrote down are not the mass eigenstate fields. We need to rotate our basis so that they are. All right, so how do we do that? Okay, so we want to diagonalize them by performing a 3x3 rotation in generation space or flavor space. So you're probably familiar with how to diagonalize Hermitian matrices. You would just diagonalize them using a unitary transformation. But there's no reason why these matrices YIJ are Hermitian. They're not in general. So we need to show how you would diagonalize any arbitrary square matrix. So what we want to do is diagonalize an arbitrary complex square matrix. And I'm going to call this matrix M. So it turns out you can diagonalize it using what's called a biunitary transformation. Instead of multiplying by U and U dagger on both sides, you multiply by different unitary matrices on both sides. That's a biunitary transformation. Let's say use biunitary transformation. So first of all, let's consider the following. We have our arbitrary square matrix M. Let's consider the quantity M dagger. So this thing is Hermitian, of course. If I just take the dagger of that, I get the same thing. So this is Hermitian. And so I can use a unitary transformation to diagonalize this one. So I have U dagger M, M dagger U is equal to some diagonal matrix, which I'll call MD squared. And so this, in general, the diagonal matrix will be some matrix which is where the entries only live along the diagonal and are positive. Okay. Now I'm going to define something called the matrix MD, which is just take the square root of MD squared of the entries living along the diagonal of our diagonal matrix here, and take the positive value when you take the square root. So I can write MD squared is just MD times MD. So now I can write what I have before. U dagger M, M dagger U is equal to MD, MD. Let's just multiply both sides on the right by the inverse of MD. And so I have U dagger M, M dagger U, MD inverse is equal to MD. So now let me call this matrix V. And so what I've shown is that U dagger M V is equal to a diagonal matrix MD. So this is the biunitary transformation. All that I need to show is that this matrix V, which I defined kind of arbitrarily here, is in fact unitary. And so it's not too hard to prove. So V is unitary. So if I write down V, dagger V, this is MD inverse U dagger M times M dagger U MD inverse. This whole thing here is just MD squared. So the whole thing is just MD inverse. MD, MD, MD inverse, which is equal to 1. So it is, in fact, unitary. So this is what it means to do a biunitary transformation. Multiply on both sides with a unitary matrix, and I end up with a matrix which is diagonal, and the eigenvalue, the entries along the diagonal are positive. OK, so next week, we're going to use this to diagonalize our Yukawa terms.